Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. Before we dive into this episode, just a reminder of all the ways you can enjoy Lungcast. If you're watching this on YouTube, be sure to subscribe to our channel at Lungcast to get updates on new episodes and interview segments. And if you're listening to this on your podcast player, you can do the same there as well. You can also get more Lungcast episodes and segments on hcplive.com and lung.org. Since the American Lung Association and HCP Live launched Lungcast in the summer of 2020, the field of respiratory health has evolved in unprecedented fashion. One doesn't have to look further than our own episode library to appreciate the great shifts in the field, brought on by a global pandemic, numerous public health phenomena, and practice-changing innovations in screening, diagnostics, prevention, and therapy. From vaccination to late-stage lung cancer care, the world of respiratory health is irrevocably changed in just a short span of 4 years. To reflect on this year's spectacular headlines in the field, we bring you to our annual recap episode, where we reflect on our favorite Lungcast interview segments of 2023. We hope you enjoyed the recap, and if you want, check out the episode notes below to interact with each interview you may have missed this year. Back in February, we discussed the unique role of thoracic surgeons in lung cancer management with Dr. Thomas Cook, the founding chief of the Division of General Thoracic Surgery at UC Davis. Among the many unique perspectives that Dr. Cook provided to the conversation was his thoughts on how he and his peers should approach stage 4 lung cancer. Let's listen in.
Getting back to lung cancer screening a bit, we know the main driver of this procedure is to shift the stage of lung cancer to an earlier stage, which is potentially more curative. Unfortunately, in clinical practice, many patients present with metastatic stage 4 disease right now. It's recognized this stage 4 group is a heterogeneous group, and despite all being characterized as stage 4, some patients have a higher disease burden compared to others. And in 2017, the updated TNM staging reclassified metastatic disease into three different groups, M1A, M1B, and M1C, because of median survival differences. Do you see this as changing the approach from a thoracic surgery standpoint to this group of individuals?
Yes, because I think those changes were made to identify a population of patients who have what's called oligometastatic disease, oligo meaning few, and disease that's metastasized to one site. So for instance, if someone has an isolated brain metastasis and otherwise early stage lung cancer other than that isolated metastasis, so no cancer in their lymph nodes, then that single metastasis to the brain could be treated with focused beam irradiation, and then their lung cancer is appropriately treated with surgery. Same thing with an isolated metastasis to a gland that sits on top of the kidney called the adrenal gland. Now, that isolated metastasis may be treated with radiation or with a combination of our surgical oncology colleagues to do a laparoscopic adrenalectomy. And then if there's no other sites of disease, including no disease in the lymph nodes, then their otherwise early stage lung cancer is treated surgically. So that really provides us with an additional armamentarium to treat our appropriately staged patients. But those decisions really need to be part of a multidisciplinary tumor board and multidisciplinary team, and those treatment decisions shouldn't be made in a vacuum.
Next in March, Dr. Ravi Kalhan, Deputy Division Chief of Pulmonary Critical Care Medicine at the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, discussed the very promising and increasingly feasible prospects of lung disease interception. Dr. Kalhan also provided a review of the ALA Lung Health Cohort research study and its own contribution to our evolving understanding of disease interception.
The last topic I'd like to address is the American Lung Association's Lung Health Cohort study, funded by NHLBI and being run through the ALA's Airways Clinical Research Centers. Can you explain what the study is and what is being monitored? And based on the discussion we just had, how do you see the long-term results of the study playing a role in defining respiratory health?
Yeah. So the Lung Health Cohort, the ALA-LHC, as we call it, is a study that we initiated. Now, it was delayed by COVID, so 18 months ago now is when we got our first participant in, or 15 months ago, something like that. And it's a study that is community-based, meaning we just want people who live freely and have nothing wrong with them, between the ages of 25 and 35 to come conduct, to come enter a long-term cohort study. So a cohort study, the definition of a cohort study is we take a population that meets certain criteria. The criteria for the lung health cohort are your age is 25 to 35 and you don't already have chronic lung disease. We pick that age range because, as we talked about before, that's the age of peak respiratory health. We want to capture adults at their best. Some of them may have lower reserves. Some of them may have, you know, high reserves. Some may be highly susceptible. But what's really important about it, Al, is one, it's a lung study. Like everything we've done in cardia is us trying to reverse engineer information from a cardiovascular study. The goals were our cardiovascular. The goals of this study are around lung health, and our phenotypic assessment is related to lung health. Spirometry, a lung CT scan, a discovery biomarker approach that includes sampling of the nasal respiratory epithelium, the nasal lining fluid, as well as the blood, and an ascertainment of exposures and behaviors that we think are important to respiratory health. So vaping, smoking, physical activity, but really importantly, also where someone has lived from birth till now. And then geocoding, very specifically, those addresses so we can estimate their exposures to airborne pollutants. Maybe in the long run, we can add exposure to airborne allergens and other things that we think influence respiratory health. So we're going to do a baseline assessment of these people with scientific goals of understanding the determinants of peak respiratory health. That is to say, all these life course pollution, pollutants, physical activity, behaviors, does that influence this concept of reserve, the peak respiratory health someone attains in young adulthood? And then in addition, figure out whether people who have lower pulmonary reserve in young adulthood, someone who has lower lung function than someone else, for example, whether that translates to abnormalities on CT scan to really understand what's going on with them and see whether it translates to a different biomarker profile so we can try to understand exactly what's happening. Then, and we're going to have to get more funding to do this, we want to conduct basically what the Framingham study has done for cardiovascular disease for respiratory health and follow these folks the rest of their lives to really understand how this evolves across the life course and identify targets to actually intercept chronic lung disease before it's clinically apparent, i.e. determine what could be the cholesterol for the lung, if you will. It's probably not going to be a single blood measure, but figure that out and then create a platform where we can actually test therapies. We should stop talking about the cholesterol for the lung, Alan. We should start talking about the statin for the lung, but test therapies that can actually stop the progression towards chronic lung disease.
An increasing prevalent topic in the fields of pediatrics, allergy, and pulmonology is the interplay of early onset allergic asthma. In May, we hosted New York-based allergist and fellow podcaster Dr. Payal Gupta, who reviewed the atopic march and its understood role in asthma and allergic disease interplay. We keep running across the term the allergic march, and I was wondering if you could tell our listeners what that means and, again, how that plays a role in practicing treating asthma.
Yeah, so the allergic march or atopic march really describes the natural progression of allergic diseases from infancy to adulthood. So atopic, again, refers to conditions like food allergy, allergic rhinitis, asthma, atopic dermatitis, and children with a family history of any allergic disease are at higher risk of having these conditions themselves. So when we talk about the allergic march, we're really talking about, you know, from birth to 1 year of age, the child might show signs of skin irritation, such as hives or eczema. And then later on, ages 1 to 3, we start seeing signs of food allergies, which, you know, the top 8-9 allergens are peanut, tree nut, nuts, cow's milk, egg, wheat, soy, shellfish, and fish, and then sesame as the newest one. that's seen. And so, and then step three in the allergic march from 4 to 6 years of age is where we see the seasonal environmental allergies start to show up, which is allergic rhinitis, allergic conjunctivitis as the presentation. And then step four, 5 to 7 years of age, we start seeing asthma, which is what we're talking about today. And so, of course, asthma can present much earlier, and we tend to call that reactive airways disease. But, you know, essentially that atopic march is this kind of progression from one allergic disease to the next.
Later on in May, we made LungCast history when we took the show on the road. We met up with first-time returning guest Dr. Ann Dixon live from the American Thoracic Society 2023 annual meeting in Washington, D.C. Dr. Dixon was the Director of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at the University of Vermont and recently was appointed as Chair of the Department of Medicine in the Larner College of Medicine at the University of Vermont. She discussed some of the interesting data around weight loss intervention for asthmatic care and presented this at ATS 2023. I really want our listeners to understand what your field of interest is and the research you're doing and what are some of the things you found at ATS to be exciting and some takeaways.
Absolutely. Well, my field of interest is in the area of obesity, metabolic dysfunction, and lung disease. And I actually got interested in this because of a study we did about 20 years ago as part of the American Lung Association Airway Clinical Research Centers, actually, where we found that a very high proportion of our people in the clinical trial with asthma had obesity, and they responded completely differently to the medication that we started them on. And that, to me, sort of really launched my research career, actually. And so I've been working in this field of metabolic dysfunction, obesity, and asthma now for about 20 years. And we've made a lot of discoveries in that time. We've discovered that there are some people who have asthma, they've had asthma since they were a child, and like the rest of the population have gained weight over time. And their asthma is complicated by the obesity. And then there's a completely different group of people who develop asthma as they get older because of the obesity. And work that we have done has really informed that in the past. And now we're really beginning to understand how metabolic dysfunction, so related to inflammatory mediators produced by adipose tissue, probably high insulin, and some of the things that cause diabetes are also affecting the lung. And I think that really came out at this meeting, the concept that when obesity and asthma react together, metabolic dysfunction is sort of critically important. And so in asthma these days, we're using a lot of drugs that target very specific pathways, targeting sort of the eosinophils, which are a cell that can cause inflammation and lead people with asthma. But now I think we're beginning to think that we really need to target obesity and metabolic dysregulation in people who are also suffering with obesity and asthma.
Yeah, I was able to attend one of the sessions earlier today that you and others were in, and a takeaway that I got from that was the role of weight loss with regard to what it does for people with asthma.
Right, and so this was a study actually that we published last year and did within the ALA's network. It was a pilot study, but we did a weight loss intervention using an internet-based weight loss intervention at two centers. We included 40 people, and we found that people who lost 5% of their weight had a very significant improvement in their asthma control score. So this threshold of about 5% seems to be very important. And I think that's a good message to get out to people, because sometimes people are like, Doc, I'm 300 pounds. I probably need to be 150 pounds. No one's going to lose 150 pounds. But if you're 300 pounds, you might be able to lose 15 pounds, and that can really affect your asthma. So I think that's a really important message that we've managed to produce from our research done with the American Lung Association.
And I guess the flip side is gaining weight certainly is not good for breathing in any way,
you know,
whether it's asthma or not.
Gaining weight is really not a good thing. And one of the things that I really worry about is, you know, some of the medications we use to treat asthma, particularly people who have poorly controlled asthma, they end up needing prednisone, they need high doses of steroids, and that may actually worsen their weight gain.
Among the biggest stories in public and environmental health this year was the mass exposure to harmful smoke and ambient air pollution from multiple wildfires across North America. During the wildfire crisis in Canada this June, Lungcast producer Kevin Kunzman and I recorded a special episode to discuss the situation and what people needed to know about the Air Quality Index, which is our barometer for harmful air during the wildfires.
Let's just start first and foremost. I think this is the most pertinent subject is identifying this metric that everyone is now coming to better appreciate in the Northeast region with regard to wildfire smoke exposure. What exactly is the Air Quality Index and what is it measuring?
Sure. So the Air Quality Index is something that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, developed to let individuals know about the quality of the air in their particular county or an area. It's made up of several pollutants, ozone, particulate matter, and then carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitric oxide, basically the six criteria pollutants. But by far and away, the most important two are ozone and particle pollution. And particle pollution is the main one right now that we're seeing make these levels so unhealthy. And right. Particle pollution itself is really fine particles. 2.5 microns is the size that is recorded. And this represents about 1/30th the size of a diameter of a hair, piece of hair. And the importance of this size is that it is able to be respired into the airways and into the airways deeper. And it travels with even smaller particles called ultrafine particles, which are 0.1 micron in size, which too can get not only deep into the lungs, but also cross that little membrane in the airways that lets them get into the vascular system, leading to potentially non-respiratory issues like cardiac events, which we know also occur at a higher rate when particle pollution is this high.
Right, right. And that sort of segues perfectly into what we wanted to talk about next is the value of understanding this metric, which, by the way, most people's interpretation right now, I'm assuming, is coming from their weather apps or other services that they're using. It's a 0 to 500 metric. So the greater number you're seeing, of course, the poorer the air quality index it is. But with regard to people's awareness of this, why they're tracking it, why they're discussing it possibly for the very first time today, what exactly are the risks? Is there a risk of people dying from poor air quality, for example?
Oh, there's no question that mortality has increased with poor air quality. I think the most recent figures that worldwide, probably 7 million people die each year based on what the World Health Organization says is poor air quality. In this country, it's in the hundreds, 100,000 or so due to air quality issues. And the reason for importance to know about this is that at fairly good air quality, the AQI is green or yellow, that's probably not going to affect most individuals outdoors. Once you get into the next category of the orange level, individuals who are at risk will start to notice some symptoms of cough, maybe a little tightness in their chest, a little wheezing. This represents people who have a known chronic lung condition, such as asthma or COPD. Right. But it also affects those who may be outdoors and not know about the risks that they have. Young children who are more active outside and breathe in air more rapidly than a normal resting adult may notice the symptoms. And the elderly are also at risk. Pregnancy, unfortunately, is another risk factor for individuals who breathe in this quality of air. It can affect their pregnancy.
Dr. Carolyn Presley, Assistant Professor of Medical Oncology at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center and the James Cancer Hospital, joined the show in June to discuss the multidisciplinary approach to lung cancer detection and treatment. A geriatric expert herself, Dr. Presley provided unique insight into the matter of age-related treatment equity for all patients with lung cancer, especially as more attention is driven toward a younger patient population.
As in many things in medical care, equity and access show disparities among different populations that we treat. Can you comment on how you see this playing out in your practice or institution? And it sounds like age is certainly an important part of what you deal with as well.
Absolutely. So I don't think there should be, any age cut off for that, at least a conversation, right? And so I really don't turn anyone away, because if they want to talk about what treatment looks like, I think that's an important conversation to have, and it's critical for shared decision making, right? And you want to, first do no harm, but having a conversation about the risks and benefits of screening, diagnosis, treatment, prognosis, all of these things are incredibly important to think about. Chronologic age is not necessarily equivalent to biologic or physiologic age. So even if someone is 50, they could be frail and be have accelerated aging, right? Depending on the exposures or lifestyle habits or behaviors. Whereas somebody in their 70s or 80s could really be as functional as somebody, you know, 10, 15 years younger. So what I really encourage clinicians, physicians, whether they're, you know, physicians or advanced practice practitioners, nurses, is to really understand, what does a typical day look like for you? And what are you able to do? What do you wish you were able to do, right? Because that really gives you more of an understanding of their function in terms of, are they able to do all of their activities of daily living and instrumental activities of daily living, or do they have mobility disability, right? Because that can really affect what treatment, if they are screened, diagnosed, right? The treatment planning. And we know that a geriatric assessment can really decrease the treatment-related toxicities that older patients experience.
What do we know about long COVID? Well, more and more every day, thanks to the work of researchers like Julia Moore Vogel. Dr. Vogel, program director of the Participant Center at Scripps All of Us Research Program, and herself a long COVID patient, connected with us in July to provide a rundown of the emerging treatments under review to help patients with long COVID, a field currently with a growing population and few available resources for them.
Is the treatment landscape changing much at all? Where do you see the research needs to be focused for this condition?
I have been very disappointed by the lack of sense of urgency to treat this condition. I think, you know, it's been very difficult because we all want the pandemic to be over and we want to just move on, because it was a very difficult time at the beginning of the pandemic for everyone to be, you know, shutting a lot of things down and minimizing social interaction and that sort of thing. And we're all just so set on getting back to life as usual that, in my view, we have conflated that, the pandemic ending, with the long COVID mass disabling event ending. And very few long COVID patients are recovering. There was just a paper this week that said about 8% of folks recover in the first 2 years. So this is just, you know, as far as we know, a very long-term syndrome that we don't have good solutions for at all. And so in my mind, we should be focusing now on clinical trials. And there are many candidates, some of which we have in our review, but there are even more resources that have come out since we published that review in January talking about what candidates we should be testing. There are just now starting to be some trials, which, you know, in my view is very late given that we're over 3 years into the pandemic, but there are, you know, a couple hundred now on clinicaltrials.gov, but most are very small sample size, you know, 100 at most. Mm-hmm. Some are 20 or 40. And so those are not going to be well powered enough to really impact care on a large scale. And those results probably won't be in for a year or two. And so I remain concerned that we are not doing enough with the clinical trials to be able to treat people in the near term. I often say, since I first got long COVID, I've been saying, I think we're 5 years away from having good treatments. And I think we're probably still 5 years away from having solid treatments. The other challenge with the small sample sizes now is, we talked about the subgroup effects, that I expect that there are going to be some things that work for some patients and some things that work for others. And so we need well-powered studies to be able to capture those differences and understand which symptom presentation can be addressed with which treatment.
In September, we brought Dr. Parth Rally, Associate Professor of Thoracic Medicine and Surgery at the Lewis Katz School of Medicine at Temple University, for our first episode of Lungcast dedicated to the topic of pulmonary embolism. In Dr. Rally's comprehensive review of the current field's diagnostics, care team and disease monitoring and care strategies, he provided outlook on what the future of pulmonary embolism diagnosis and treatment may entail.
Would you like to comment on where you see things going in the field, going further, whether there's new diagnostic or new therapeutic modalities?
Yes, absolutely. I think I would comment on the diagnostic and treatment, both modalities. I think one of the cool thing is happening in the space is that we have the AI softwares who can not only diagnose the PE, but also can stratify based on RV to LV ratio. So there are three commercially available softwares where you can directly, as soon as somebody has a CAT scan done on the table, you get an instant notification before patient comes off the table. Think about it, what happens right now. Somebody orders a CAT scan, happens after a few hours, and by the time that it gets ready, it's another few hours, and by the time the report gets back to the ER, change of shift happens. So all of this is completely out, because as soon as patient comes off the table, you get a text notification, you can review the images, you can review the RV-12V ratio right hand there, you can activate your PERT team, you can communicate with your PERT team. So all this upfront 6-8 hours that we lose in diagnostic and prognostication has get nullified. So I think that's where the field is evolving. And that's absolutely fascinating. We are lucky at Temple that we have that technology that we are using. I think that is spreading out very fast. And it's not only for PE, the same applications will diagnose your MI and your aortic dissection. So I think going back to your question, can you anticoagulate them faster? Absolutely you can. Right. Because now you're a ER physician who gets a notification saying you have a clot. You're going to put anticoagulation. By the time patient comes, heparin or low and oxygen is ready to go in. So I think it has a diagnostic, therapeutic, and risk stratification too. I think where the field is evolving, I think this entire spectrum of this catheter-based treatment, we are into the phase of, we have not only one, two, but at least four randomized controlled trials comparing the different advanced treatment options, meaning comparing catheter-directed lysis with catheter-directed thrombectomy, a trial called PLS trial. That is a high-pytho trial which is comparing catheter-directed lysis to anticoagulation only, because there is a group of believers that catheter-directed therapies don't help the patient. So there is an RCT happening for that. There is also RCT happening for some half-dose TPA enthusiastic in Europe and Northern Canada, PYTHO 3, looking at half-dose TPA versus anticoagulation and see in the intermediate-risk PE. So I think there are a lot of RCTs happening. So I think we'll not only have opinion-based statements, but I think we'll have an evidence-based statements in next few years for that which treatment should be offered and which not. And finally, I think as we briefly talked about, that whole world of post-PE is changing. I hope that guidelines recognize that. So I think I expect that, and I'm not liberated to say much, but I expect that there would be much more post-PE specific guidelines will come out from societies, because acute PE is one separate thing and post-PE phenotypes itself needs its own guidelines. So I hope that some of the societal guidelines will start coming out on post-PE management, which is currently more of a consensus-based opinion statement. So I think those are the things happening in the next 5 years.
Fewer fields had more landmark developments and successes this year than respiratory syncytial virus. In just 12 months, we saw the FDA approval of two vaccine options for the seasonal virus, as well as a monoclonal antibody, all of which were designed to help curb severe cases and mortality in our high-risk infant and elderly person populations. On the eve of 2023-2024 RSV season this September, we spoke with Dr. Barbara Taylor, Associate Professor of Infectious Diseases and Assistant Dean for the MD-MPH program at the University of Texas Health, San Antonio, on the new tool set for RSV, how to limit its annual burden.
So this is really exciting to have an option for older adults. This is a relatively new recommendation that came down over the summer. The FDA approved two in May, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Council Committee on Immunization Praxis, or ACIP, released guidance on June 21st. And the current recommendation is recommending shared decision-making. So what you were talking about, Dr. Rizzo, with the need to have conversations and combat misinformation is really at the forefront of the ACIP's recommendations for this. So they recommend shared decision-making for adults aged 60 or older and vaccination before or at the onset of the RSV season. So they really want you to have a conversation with patients, or for if you're in the community, to have a conversation with your medical provider about the risk and benefits of these new vaccines. This is both because the vaccines are incredibly effective at preventing cases of RSV, particularly the lower respiratory tract infection that we worry so much about in older people. But there were some instances of immune sort of activation in these trials that they want people to know about and make an informed decision about before they get vaccinated. So there are two vaccines. One is called Arexvy. It's made by GlaxoSmithKline and Sanofi. And one is by is called Abrysvo, and that's made by Pfizer. Both of them are protein-based vaccines that target the pre-fusion F protein that we've been talking about so much. Both of them, so the Arexvy vaccine was tested in over 24,000 people across 17 countries. It was effective against both RSV A and B and had really outstanding efficacy of almost 83% against RSV-associated lower respiratory tract disease. It also was effective, very effective against severe respiratory tract disease in the 94% and against overall any acute respiratory tract infection. There was in this trial one case of Guillain-Barré syndrome, one death due to acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, which may or may have not been related to the vaccine, but was occurred in someone who got an RSV vaccine and the flu vaccine simultaneously. And there were some interesting, it's not statistical, but there was a numerical predisposition for atrial fibrillation in the vaccine arm. So the FDA has said that there will be post-marketing surveillance for all three of those things in the rollout of this vaccine. The Abrysvo, the Pfizer vaccine, is also pre-fusion F protein vaccine. It doesn't have an adjuvant. That was trialed in over 34,000 adults across seven countries. I think the efficacy is very similar. Overall efficacy against lower respiratory tract infection was 86%. Overall infection, more protective against severe infections. And similarly, they also saw one incident of Guillain-Barré syndrome. They saw an incident of Miller-Fisher and a hypersensitivity reaction. The good news is, so high efficacy, overall, the side effects on both, for both of those vaccines were very mild. People had 15% of people had fatigue. There was 11% had pain at the injection site, some headaches, some muscle pain. Fever was very rare, which is incredibly helpful in a vaccine. As an infectious disease doctor, there's always the, does my patient have a new illness or do they just have a vaccine reaction? So I think the caveats are that we have these two new vaccines, which are highly effective. Neither of these studies that I just mentioned had many participants who were 80 and above, and they also didn't have many participants who were frail or in long-term care facilities. And so I think it's important for us to pay attention to the post-marketing pharmacovigilance to see what happens with those populations. The other caveat, as you noticed in the recommendation from ACIP, the timing of vaccination is supposed to be before the start of the RSV season, and our RSV season has already started. Right. So they are basically saying, offer them as soon as they become available, because I think we're going to need them this fall.
This month, we brought our air quality-related health discussions full circle with Dr. Mark Hernandez, the S.J. Archuleta Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Director of the Aerobiology and Disinfection Lab at the University of Colorado, who shared insights into the matter of indoor air pollution exposures. Particularly, Dr. Hernandez provided a rundown of the signs and symptoms of unhealthy air exposure in public places like our schools.
I know your background as an engineer, so this question may be a little bit off, but in the epidemiologic studies you've quoted, are there certain things that parents and healthcare providers should kind of look for when they think that unhealthy exposure at school might be playing a role in a child's behavior? And you mentioned tiredness. Is that kind of the main thing? Easy fatigue ability?
Yeah. I'm not a medical
person. I understand, right?
Yeah. I work with them. And I've worked with a lot of school districts. I've been in a lot of school buildings, met a lot of facility managers and superintendents. And, they're all in very different situations, depending on the district politics, how schools are funded and so on. But what I can say is that almost all of them I've met, especially post-pandemic, are doing something to resource their districts to get to this issue, right? Normalizing social vulnerability, trying to find, prioritize what are my problems in my buildings and moving resources to do that rather than responding to generalized symptoms. And again, you know, health practitioners, I think data from the schools can help health practitioners. I'm not sure that engineers looking for clusters of symptoms or other indicators are a good way to go. And I refrain from doing that. I just use the indicators in the classrooms and try to normalize that and help the supers and facility managers improve the air quality as best they can. Right now, we're actually doing the study of absenteeism in conjunction with the University of Colorado Medical School to get to the very point. Does improved air quality that we measure over many semesters actually result in lowered absenteeism associated with respiratory effects? So we're in the throes of doing that. And that's where I see us staying, right? Working with the medical community to look at this as a public health, not an individual, or even down to a cluster level.
And we moved a bit out of order here at the end of the recap, but our last look back is on our November episode for Lung Cancer Awareness Month. We had the privilege to share the story of Christy Fisher, a four-time survivor of non-smoking stage 4 lung cancer over the last 17 years. Amid a year of conversations with objective experts in clinical care and academic research, Christy's talk stood out as a rallying cry for patients facing life-threatening circumstances in pulmonary diseases, particularly her final message on how to keep living while fighting lung cancer. What would be the big message to patients when they're diagnosed? I know we often hear that when that first term of lung cancer is brought to the patient's attention, they kind of zone out for a period of time. They don't hear anything else after that because of that setting.
I know.
It sounded like you had a fairly supportive group around you, family and friends as well, but what would you tell patients when they get this diagnosis?
With me, the thing that was most important to me is that I maintained who I was and what I was doing in my life, that was really important to me. That, as I mentioned earlier, I'm extremely competitive. And so I look at being diagnosed with lung cancer as a competition. I do. I look at it as I won't let it beat me. I won't let it take up any more of my time than it has to. I won't bow down to it. You know, I literally treat it like it's something I'm competing against, because I think if you give up, if you let it overcome you, then it will. So what I would tell anybody is if you're diagnosed with lung cancer or any other form of cancer, keep living. Just keep living your life. Keep moving forward. Keep having something to do. Keep looking for the joy and the happiness in your life. And keep finding that great thing that you can do next. And don't sit back and, you know, let it consume you that you have any type of cancer or lung cancer or any form of cancer. You know, just keep moving forward and being alive and living, you know, and not let it get the best of you. And that's what I do. I mean, I don't spend any time at all thinking about the fact that I have stage 4 lung cancer and that I'm on treatment right now. Every day I take a form of treatment. It's a targeted therapy, but I don't think about it. I still get up and I do my thing. I volunteer. I walk every day. I go out on my boat. You know, I mean, I've been on some trips in our camper. I live my life. And I think that's what everybody needs to do. Just live your life and work cancer into it as you have to.
That is going to be it for our 2023 recap. I want to take a moment here after 3.5 years and more than 40 episodes to thank everyone who's helped make LungCast such a rewarding project for us at the American Lung Association and at HCP Live. We're happy to tell our 1,000-fold subscribers and the 10-fold listeners to that amount that we'll be recording new monthly episodes of LungCast into 2024 and beyond. So if you haven't yet, take some time to subscribe to the show on your podcast platform and on YouTube, and check out lung.org and hcplive.com for more content from every episode. From the American Lung Association, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. Have a happy and healthy holiday season.